struggle not to fall asleep. I was glad of the cover of darkness, though, because it left me free to think. I had made up my mind that I would follow Serenity when she went to the library that night, and after the meeting, I would follow whoever looked most like the leader of the group. I didn't know what it would prove or reveal, but I wanted to see them and get my own scent impressions, if I could. I would have told Jilly what I intended at lunchtime, but a girl from our science class came hurrying in at the end of the presentation to say she was wanted urgently in the science lab. Jilly grimaced resignedly as she went out, but I knew she loved science and was pleased that Mr. Straven relied on her so much. Left alone, and seeing Harlan headed outside with some other guys, I went to the library, determined to learn the correct name for the reverse swastika. I sat down at a table to draw it, so I could show the librarian without a lot of explanation. On impulse, I drew in the yellow snakes, in case they meant something to her. Then I noticed Harlan standing on the other side of the desk. He had not yet seen me, but I could tell that he was searching. I was certain he'd gone outside deliberately to make me think the coast was clear, and I had fallen for it, since there was no way out of the library but past the desk, and he would spot me at once if I moved. I forced myself to calm down. I might just as well stay where I was and wait for him to notice me. Then I would beam at him with delight, and no matter what he suspected, that would confound him. I would probably have to agree to a meeting, but I'd say it couldn't be until the school holidays. Fortunately, they were still a couple of weeks off. Harlan saw me, and I smiled and raised my hand. He looked really startled for a second. Then he came towards me. To my astonishment, my danger sense went berserk. I clamped hard and tried frantically to think why it would react so violently when it hadn't that morning in English. Fortunately, the librarian called out to ask Harlan something, and flustered with panic, I folded my drawing and stuffed it into my pocket. Like a switch being thrown, my keening danger sense fell silent. Unable to take in what had happened, I took the drawing out again, and at once my senses began to shrill. I stuffed the paper quickly in my pocket again, and the shrilling died away, even though Harlan was approaching, his smell as hideous as ever. "Hello, stranger," he said. "Glad to see you without your watchdog." "Hi," I said, sounding stiff to my own ears and wishing I was a better actress. But I intensely disliked him referring to good, kind Jilly as a watchdog. "I'm not letting you out of my sight until you name a place and time for our date." His voice was caressing and amused, but determined. I crossed my fingers and said brightly, "That would be great. We could meet after school one night in the mall. I love that cafe we were going to meet in before." "I was thinking more along the lines of a drive-in," Harlan said. "Drive-in?" I echoed, startled. "I didn't think those existed anymore." "There's one out in the back road between Shaletown and Remington. There's a retro cafe attached to it," Harlan said. "I can have a friend drive us out there in my mother's car." Even though I was casting about desperately to find a good excuse to refuse the arrangement, a bit of me couldn't believe how arrogant Harlan was, assuming that his friend would chauffeur us around. Maybe the arrogance was not Harlan's. I said, diffidently, "I don't think my dad would agree to a drive-in. I can ask him, though."
"Tell him it'll be a comedy," Harlan instructed, "and tell him I'd take very good care of his little girl."
I managed with great effort not to shudder. When he left, I took the drawing out again, and this time, when I smoothed it flat, my senses were quiet. I played devil's advocate with myself. Maybe it wasn't that Harlan was connected to the Shaletown gang, or maybe he was, and the swastika emblem was just a recycled logo, like Jezebel had suggested, in which case there might be no connection between the Shaletown gang and the book under Serenity's bed. Only Harlan had gone to school in Shaletown and hung around with at least one skinhead, and Serenity's problems seemed to have begun in Shaletown, and the gang with the swastika logo was based in Shaletown. And besides all that, why would my danger sense go crazy at the possibility that Harlan would see the drawing I had made if there was no connection? Then a memory slid into my mind. Harlan giving me the green flash drive for Serenity. I realized then that I had to go back to Shaletown. I didn't know how all the stuff with the gang and the swastika connected to Harlan, but I wanted to find out.
because the thing I feared most was that Harlan, who carried a contagious sickness of the spirit, was involved with my spiritually wounded sister. The remainder of the day, I spent my time uselessly willing classes to go faster. I was like a dog tied to a stump, wanting nothing more than to be free to follow my own desires. But at last the school day ended. I couldn't tell Jilly what I meant to do, because her grandmother was in the car waiting with Samuel. I hadn't seen the old woman since the night I had gone to her home, after the last visit to Shaletown, and she looked startlingly frail and old, but she smiled warmly and told me to come and see them soon. Jilly was touchingly protective of her, and as I waved them off, I was glad I had said nothing about my intention to spy on Serenity's poetry group. She had enough on her plate without worrying about me as well. I spent an hour doing homework in the school library to give Serenity time to get into her meeting. Harrison had said she worked for a while before going into the meeting room, and I didn't want to risk lurking in the city library where she might spot me. The other advantage of hanging around was that there was less chance of bumping into Harlan, though I felt as if our meeting in the library had taken the pressure off me a bit. There were only two older kids waiting for the city bus, and in a short time I was getting out at the city library. I was fairly sure I had left enough time for Serenity to get into the meeting room, but just in case, I came in through the main door into the entrance hall warily. There were six meeting rooms along the left wall, but four stood open and empty. Only two were shut. The glass doors to the library were on the right side, facing the two closed doors, and I lingered, pretending to read the opening hours stenciled on the doors. But even with my hearing fully extended, I couldn't make out more than a hum of talk. That meant there was soundproofing in the walls, like in Da's shed. I was disappointed, but my main aim was not to eavesdrop on the poetry meeting. I went through into the library, intending to position myself so that I could see straight through the glass doors into the hall, so that I would see anyone coming out of the closed meeting rooms. The best spot was behind the magazine racks, because if Serenity happened to come into the library after leaving the meeting, she would never go there. The only catch was that the shelves were waist high, so I would have to squat the whole time, but being close to the door, I would also be able to get out quickly to follow my quarry. I checked my watch again, and then went to the other checkout desk to ask the pimple-faced guy on the other side of the counter if my stamp-collecting club had begun their meeting already. He frowned and said he didn't think there was a stamp-collecting club scheduled in any of the meeting rooms. He pulled out a ledger and ran his finger down a page. Then he shook his head, saying I must have got the day wrong, as the only meetings were a regular poetry group meeting and some people trying to organize funding for a jazz festival. I asked when those would end, and the guy said both groups had booked an hour slot, which meant they would end in about 20 minutes. The only other thing booked for that evening was a Probus women's group at 7. I pretended to be puzzled, and he suggested the meeting I wanted might be at East Library on the other side of the city. I wandered off, trying to look disconsolate, but a backwards glance showed me that my performance was wasted. He'd already forgotten me in the process of checking out a great pile of books for an elderly couple. I went to squat down behind the magazine rack, but I had been there barely 5 minutes when a whole bunch of people lined up at the checkout desk, blocking my view completely. Cursing myself for not anticipating this, I knew I had about 5 minutes to find another spot before the meeting ended. There was nowhere else in the library, I realized, and the only other choice was to wait outside. But when I came into the hall, I had a brainwave. I could hide in the empty meeting room nearest the two occupied rooms. It wasn't ideal, because I would only have an oblique view of the glass library doors, but I should be able to peep out at whoever was coming out of the meeting rooms without being spotted, because no one would have any reason to look in my direction. I just made it inside the darkened room when I heard the door to one of the meeting rooms open. I was pretty sure it was the room next to the one I was in, and I was about to stick my head out to see if I could see Serenity, when a voice behind me said softly, "Oh, wouldn't it bother?" My heart gave a great bound of fright, and I swung round to find Harrison sitting on the table closest to the door. His pale hair glowed, and his spectacles reflected rectangles of light from the door, with me arrested in them like an ant trapped in amber. I was so shocked I couldn't speak. Harrison got to his feet and came over to me. "That's the festival people," he said softly. "The poetry group are in the room next to them, and they're not due to come out for another 5 minutes."
Whatever are you doing here?" I gasped.
He grinned, a slice of white in the dimness. "Same thing as you, I guess. Thought it might be interesting to take a second look at the weird poetry group."
"Why?" I asked.
He shrugged. "Watching a person once isn't enough to get a clear picture of anything. You need to watch a few times to be able to establish patterns."
He heard the sound of another door opening. Harrison put a finger to his lips.
I nodded, and we both turned to look out into the hall, though of course we couldn't see anything without leaning out of the doorway. I extended my hearing until I could detect people moving into the hallway and down the passage, some going into the library and others going through the front door and down the steps, but none of them were talking, which seemed pretty odd. I didn't move because, now that the door was open, I could hear the sound of chairs being stacked and desks shifted. Someone was straightening the room, and my heart quickened because it was likely to be the person running the group. That was who I wanted to see. At last, I heard the light snap off. Footsteps came into the passage and stopped. I strained my hearing, wondering what he was doing. Then I heard footsteps on the terracotta tiles. A heavy man's tread, I thought, then registered in horror that they were not going away, but coming towards the room where we were hiding. My senses instantly screamed of danger. I turned in silent panic to Harrison, who'd grown rigid beside me. He stared at me for a split second, then he took off his glasses. His grey eyes looked silver in the dim light, and I had time to note there was no fear in them as he reached out and pulled me into his arms. Before I could protest, his mouth was on mine. Of course, I realized immediately what he was doing. I clamped hard on my senses, and at the same time, I made my body passive and leaned into him, just as a man came to stand in the doorway, watching us. I saw him at the corner of a slitted eye. He smelled of burned rubber, petrol, and the sharp chemical stink of formalin. Then he was gone, and so was the smell. The danger sense faded at once, and I ought to have stepped away, but the minute Harrison's lips had touched mine, I had felt his feelings, anger, determination, and a powerful curiosity. Then I had become aware of a second level of feelings, fiercely repressed. Harrison knew what this contact would mean, and was trying to keep his deeper feelings from me. But the kiss was too intimate and too prolonged, and even though some bit of me registered that the man had gone, I did not let go and step away. Instead, my clamp seemed to dissolve, and I was filled with a hungry heat and the intoxicating smell of storm and lavender and wet leaves. I wound my arms tightly around him, pressing myself the whole length of him, pushing my fingers into hair that was astonishingly soft. My whole body seemed to want to merge with his, and at the same time, I felt my senses penetrate his, wanting whatever was being withheld. I let my tongue touch his, demanding access to the sweetness I sensed. He groaned against my mouth, then violently wrenched away from me. I stared at him, shocked, yet a potent residue of all that I had felt was churning and boiling through my veins, urging me back into his arms. Harrison's face was chalk white, his cheekbones standing out under eyes that were mercury-bright rings around huge, dark pupils. He looked appalled. Mortification flowed through me like a tide of lava. "God, I'm so sorry. I don't know why I acted..." I heard the agonizing shame in my voice and lifted my hands to my cheeks. They felt ice cold and feverishly hot at the same time. Some of the starkness seemed to go from his face. "You didn't," he began urgently. But he checked himself and shook his head hard. Then he put on his glasses and said in a voice striving for calmness, "Look, we'll talk about this later, but we have to go or we'll lose him." I felt sick. I ached. I felt like crying. I nodded. Harrison stepped past me and looked out. I stayed where I was, leaning against the open door, trying to get control of my body. A few minutes passed, or 10 hours. Then Harrison said tersely, "He's gone out. Let's go." I made myself follow. My legs felt unsteady, and I had to bite my lips to keep the tears back. I had never felt more confused in my life. What had happened to me? How could I have clung to him like that and kissed him so hungrily? God, I had tongue-kissed him. I had wanted... And the look of shock and disgust on his face. What must he think of me? But even thinking of that moment when my tongue had touched his made me feel as if there was still a meltdown going on inside me. Harrison stopped abruptly at the entrance to the library, then looked out. I guessed that Serenity must be waiting for Dar, but when I looked past him, I saw, with a stab of alarm, that there was a guy standing and talking to her. He was not a skinhead, though his hair was very short, and he was older than I had expected, maybe 30. I extended my senses, but neither of them were speaking just then. Serenity was looking through her bag, and then, wordlessly, she drew out a book and gave it to the man. The yellow book. He nodded and reached out to clasp her shoulder. Then she turned and went away down the street. Guy watched her for a long moment. Then he crossed the street and went in the other direction. "Come on," Harrison said decisively. We hurried down the library steps, and as we reached street level, I glanced back in the direction Serenity had gone and saw that she was some distance away, walking swiftly. Harrison had already set off after the guy, and I hurried to catch him up. But when I made across the street, he shook his head. "We can follow less conspicuously from this side of the street." I nodded, ashamed all over again at what had happened in the meeting room. What must he think of me, turning a clever ruse to protect us from discovery into some sort of impassioned embrace? The guy we were following was walking swiftly and with purpose, and he didn't look back once. He wasn't holding anything in his hands, so he must have slipped the booklet into his pocket. "He's headed for the highway," I said, as I realized the guy was turning down a lane which led to a road that ran parallel to it. Once we reached the road, I felt immediately exposed because there were no trees and few cars. If our quarry glanced back, he would see us. But without warning, he vanished. "He's taken one of the underpasses," Harrison said urgently, and broke into a run. By the time we got to the underpass entrance, the man was out of sight. I stared at the sign in dismay, because it said the underpass split in two. One path would take us to the bus station, and the other to the mall. "I'll be too far along for us to see which way he went," Harrison said. "Choose." "Eastland Mall," I said. I would have raced down the steps, but Harrison pointed to the highway. I understood at once. If we crossed over it, we would arrive at the mall first. We scaled the concrete barrier and dodged across the highway, which, at that time of night, was crammed with traffic. Luckily, there was so much of it that it was virtually at a standstill. Beyond the barrier on the other side was an enormous car park. We wove through the cars, not troubling to hide ourselves, because there was no chance of the guy we were following seeing us. By the time we reached the fountain in the square where the underpass came out, we were both panting hard. I sat on the damp stone rim, positioning myself so that the water would screen us from anyone coming out of the tunnel. Not that the man would recognize us if he did see us, because I had been plastered too close to Harrison for anyone to have got a good look at our faces back in the meeting room. Firmly, I shoved down the embarrassment that coiled up in me like a snake. "That wasn't the bald guy who warned you off last time," I said, surprised how normal my voice sounded. "No," Harrison agreed. "This guy's older and bulkier." "Did you see them go into the meeting last time?" He nodded. "It was your sister and about seven others, as well as the guy with the shaved head. All young and all loner types, I'd say. Hard to see why they'd belong to a group." "Did you see the book Serenity gave the guy?" I asked. Harrison nodded, and I told him about finding Serenity, pushing it under her bed, and what I had read in it. He looked blank when I described the symbol in the back, so I had to tell him about the swastika in the bus shelter and what the woman had said about it being the symbol of a Shaletown gang. It might be that the symbol is just one of those recycled images that start cropping up everywhere, but your instincts say not. Well, it was also how you described the guy that stopped you going into the poetry meeting. He sounded like a thug. Harrison nodded. That's exactly what he looked and acted like. But why would a gang tough be messing with this yellow book and a poetry club? unless it's propaganda and they're recruiting. But what sort of gang sets up as a poetry group to collect members?
I hesitated, then said what I had barely allowed myself to think. What if it's not members they're recruiting, but victims?
I told him what happened in the library with Harlan and the drawing I had made. It's like my senses were telling me it was dangerous to let him see it. And why would that be, unless it was connected to the sickness in him?
Well, there could be other reasons, but are you saying you think he's part of this gang in Shaletown?
I know he went to school in Shaletown before he came here, and I've seen him a couple of times with tough guys who were at school with him there, and one was a skinhead. What if he's still part of the gang, and he, or the sickness in him, is using it to find victims?
Harrison looked pale and grim.
Jesus, if that's true, that means your sister...
He stood abruptly and looked out to the overpass outlet.
It's taken too long. It'd have been here by now if it'd come this way. He must have gone the other direction. Let's take the underpass to the bus depot and see if he's waiting for a bus.
We sprinted down the stairs and through the long green-painted urine-smelling underpass tunnel with its flickering, insect-filled fluorescent lights. There was a lot of graffiti on the sweating walls, but no reverse swastikas with snakes. We came out right at the door of the depot terminal and stopped, again panting hard. There were six concrete islands lying parallel like fish left to dry on a rack, and three big buses and one local bus parked, each disgorging or boarding people and luggage. Announcements coming through a loudspeaker mounted on a pole by the underpass outlet were advising that one of the buses would depart in 10 minutes. We ran frantically for 5 useless minutes. Then Harrison said we ought to calm down and look methodically. After 15 minutes we gave up. Either our quarry had caught a bus or he'd cut through the depot to the suburb on the other side and was long gone.
"Let's see if any of the buses have just gone," said Harrison.
I felt suddenly drained of purpose and energy, and my stomach ached hollowly, though I did not feel hungry.
Harrison led the way across to the terminal, which was a great barn of a place with a high roof of glass arching over a metal frame made to look, for some reason, like a giant fish skeleton. There were restrooms and seats and a kiosk, and above, a row of glass-fronted desks where you could buy tickets, a big board where white numbers and letters on black squares flipped and clicked over to reveal bus destinations and times of departure and arrival. The first departure listed was for 10 minutes' time.
"Earlier departures have gone off the board. Let's ask," Harrison said.
He went forward to one of the counters, and I trailed after him, longing for a hot chocolate and thinking I ought to call home and let them know I was okay. Harrison came back to me.
"Guess what?"
I shook my head, unable to see how anything the guy behind the counter could have said would have got him so electrified.
"A bus to Shaletown left 5 minutes before we got here," Harrison said.
33. "You were going to say something about Serenity back there when we were by the fountain," I reminded Harrison. We were sitting in the bus station cafeteria under a blare of fluorescent lights, having hot chocolates out of thin plastic cups that buckled with the heat if you didn't hold them lightly enough. He nodded.
"I was going to say that if that poetry group is a way of collecting potential victims, it means your sister might be in a lot of danger, which is what your senses have been telling you all along."
I nodded, feeling cold and afraid. "You know, when I was first back at school after the accident, Helen gave me a flash drive for Serenity. That's the first time I was close enough to smell him, and it wasn't long after that he started asking me out."
"Maybe he got close enough for the sickness to pick up your reaction to how he smelled," Harrison said. "But what's the book for? I mean, how could it have anything to do with Serenity being a possible victim for the sickness in Harlan?"
Harrison pondered this for a while, running his fingers through the blonde lock of hair that fell over his forehead.
Maybe the book is part of preparing for someone being infected. Like, you're more susceptible to the flu if your resistance is low. The poetry group is, first of all, a way of luring people in whose spirits might be weakened, and then the aim is to weaken them further.
But Harrison, that yellow book wasn't just a computer-generated book that anyone with a bit of savvy could put together.
It was a proper printed book. That would take serious money and organization. Maybe gang is a misnomer. This group might be a lot more organized than it seems. Maybe this Shaletown gang is an actual club, with sponsors and members, and even a clubhouse. They would have the means to produce a proper book. You're saying a club of people like Harlan, all infected, aren't you? But those guys I saw with Harlan were not infected. They smelled bad, but not like he does. That's a good point. Unless he has infected them, and the sickness hasn't matured enough to become active yet, so you can't smell it. Or maybe he couldn't infect them because they were not able to be infected. Maybe a spirit needs to be wounded to be vulnerable to infection. I shuddered. The thought of a group of people like Harlan plotting to get victims is horrible, I said. And the idea of Serenity at the mercy of such people filled me with fear. But what could I do? I could hardly tell Da or the police or even Serenity what we suspected. I would sound like a maniac. We have to find out more about this Shaletown gang, Harrison said. You mentioned that Harlan went to a school in Shaletown, so I think we should start there. What is it? I was shaking my head as I told him about my abortive visit to Shaletown and the later discovery that the school had closed down. The only other thing I thought of was going to the neighbourhood where the school was and talking to neighbours. I got the address from an old phone book. Clever girl, he said, looking impressed. So, we go there. Can you take another day off without the sky falling in? I nodded at once. Then I told him something else that had occurred to me. I think that Shaletown gang has something to do with the fire at Jilly's place. Remember how angry she said Harlan looked when she ran into him the day I stood him up because of Sari? You think he put the gang up to it? I don't know, I said, but he was annoyed at her always being around. A wave of remorse flowed over me. If it's because of me that her grand's house was burned down... My fingers were plaited together so tightly they were hurting, but before I could order them to loosen, Harrison had put a hand over them. It was done instinctively, on an impulse out of pity and sympathy, which I felt when our skins touched. But then Harrison almost snatched his hand away, as if he was remembering what had happened before when he touched me. I felt my cheeks redden, and I wanted the ground to swallow me up. I wanted to say something light and offhand, but I couldn't seem to speak. Allison, look at me, Harrison said. His voice was warm and gentle, and so I did. Allison, listen. Back there in the library, when I kissed you. I know, I said, cutting him off. I know you did it to stop that guy seeing us and getting suspicious. I don't know why I acted like I did. Allison, you didn't need to feel bad about how you reacted, because the way you reacted, well, it wasn't you. I stared at him, bewildered. I felt what I was feeling. Harrison ended my sentence flatly. You see, I did kiss you to stop that guy getting suspicious, but having a girl in my arms... Oh, Allison, what can I say? I'm a guy, and there's just this inevitable biological reaction. Only in this case, your senses thought that what you were getting from me was coming from you. Relief flooded through me, and it struck me that he had been both kind and courageous in saying all this to me. I felt suddenly weightless. It was not that what I had felt had been so horrible, but it had been so overwhelming, like being the earth for some violent elemental force. But not my force, I assured myself. I had just been a conduit. So, will you forget it happened? Harrison asked. I nodded, but of course I would not forget. How could I? In a sense, it had been my first real kiss, and what a kiss. If anyone had asked before, I would have said that Harrison was probably as inexperienced as I was, but there had been no awkwardness or hesitation in how he had held me. It was getting late, so we finished our cold hot chocolates, and Harrison walked me back to the library. By the time we were at my bus stop, we made our plan to meet at the train stop. Harrison had offered to get Raoul to call the school, pretending to be Da, and say I was ill. What about your parents?
There's just my dad, and he won't care. My mother died when I was born, and he kind of lost interest in life after that.
There was something in his tone that made me think of the stern barrier I had come upon inside him. It struck me that none of us, Harrison or Jilly, me or Sari, had normal mothers. It was one of those significant-seeming things that didn't add up to anything. I caught the bus home with Harrison's admonition to be careful ringing in my ears. Perhaps that was why I felt such a powerful rush of relief and gladness to see Da sitting at the table reading a book when I entered the kitchen. I rushed at him and hugged him without remembering what the consequence might be, but I felt only a warm, lovely envelope of love enfold me. "Hey, I missed you, Alley Cat," Da said, smiling. It was something he'd called me when I was about 5, and had spent half the time pretending I was a stray cat that had wandered in, pestering everyone for pats and bowls of milk, and hissing when I was ignored. "I wondered where you'd got to." "I was with Harrison," I said, sliding onto a stool. "So, what happened with the gig, anyway?" I kept my tone carefully light.
"It was interesting."
"Interesting," I persisted, not liking the word.
"Well, it was unusual, because, as well as a lot of artistic types in the audience, there were dozens of musicians, some of them pretty big in their various fields. I've never performed to so many performers before. It was an honor in a way."
"I thought it was a charity function."
"Oh, it was. But it wasn't a fundraiser. The performers and the sponsors were being thanked by the charity for their help during the last year. And there were a lot of speeches in between performances about future projects. So I guess everyone was being nicely warned that they'd be needed again."
"Was Aaron Race there?"
Da nodded. "He gave one of the speeches about an annual charity fundraising event coming up at Castledean Estate, which is his property."
My skin prickled. "He didn't happen to invite you to perform at it, did he?"
Da laughed. "No, he did not. But I wouldn't have minded if he had. Provided he asked me with losing the rope. I all but said as much, as a matter of fact."
"Good for you," I said. "Who else performed besides you?"
"Lots of people. There were a couple of rap guys called Neo Tokyo who were pretty good. Neo is Nick and Tokyo is Tahu. He's Mari. Nice guys, but very young. The biggest name was Iraq."
"I don't like their music."
"I don't much like it either," Da admitted. "It's not that their musicianship is bad. In fact, the guitarist is brilliant, but their lyrics are so savage and judgmental."
He laughed and shook his head.
"I must be getting old."
"Being angry isn't the same as being young," I said. He gave me a surprised look.
"Well, no, I guess it's not. But a lot of the time it does seem to be the same thing, doesn't it?"
"Maybe kids think that's how they're supposed to be, because musicians and writers keep telling them so."
Da said thoughtfully, "Well, now that you mention it, maybe that's why the Neo Tokyo boys seemed so confused to me. They have a great energy, but it's as if they're trying to push it into this angry, edgy stuff like the Rack does. I suspect they have something different to say, or they would, if they made the effort to figure it out rather than just emulating the Rack."
"I bet Aaron Race loved them," I said, thinking of how Angel Blue and the other artists he had been associated with had changed.
"I don't know if he liked it, but he did say that the Rack's music expresses an anger that people feel but can't show, that it offers an outlet that doesn't hurt anyone."
He paused.
"He asked me to play a couple of numbers with them."
"And did you do it?" I asked. He laughed at my expression.
"I told them I couldn't do their music or songs, so they suggested using a couple of my songs. I was taken aback, because I would have thought my music would be anathema to them. We spent a whole day rehearsing and adapting the two songs we had decided on. It was interesting, but a little disturbing, too. They put their spin on what I had written, and it was like seeing a part of myself transformed and taking part in that transformation, and at the same time standing back and watching it happen. I also did a couple of Losing the Rope songs with Neo Tokyo. They were nowhere near as polished as the Rack, but I have to say I enjoyed it a whole lot more. They seemed to understand the music better, and when they altered it, they just added something new to it, rather than turning it on its head."
He smiled. I smiled too, because although I was sure Aaron Race was out to change Da to make him saleable in a certain way, seeing him smiling and sitting there, looking as he always did, made me feel he was too complete,
too grounded in his honesty and beliefs to be manipulated. Mum came in, wearing a drifting green shirt over tight black pants, her hair a cloud of red floating around her shoulders. She looked beautiful and sexy and stunning, so much so that she didn't quite seem human. I thought, as I had sometimes thought before, that it was probably lucky that she was nocturnal and a recluse. Imagine how people would stare if such a vision were to move among them, acting like any other person. I wanted to laugh at the absurdity of my thought. Then I looked at Da and was jolted to see the adoration in his eyes. For some reason, the look that passed between them reminded me of Harrison's kiss, and I got up abruptly. But as I reached the door, I heard Mum tell Da that she was painting Serenity. I turned in time to see a troubled look on Da's face.
"You're painting Serenity?"
Da repeated.
"I have been wanting to paint her for some time," Mum told him gently.
She reached out and touched his cheek. A little puzzled by the exchange, I went to have a shower. I had been determined to tell Da about Serenity the moment I saw him, but what had happened that night with Harrison had changed my mind. Lying in bed a little later, I felt heavy with tiredness, but also eager for the night to be over so I could go with Harrison to Shaletown to see if we could learn more about the Shaletown gang and Harlan Sanderson's connection with it. But on the verge of falling asleep, I found myself vividly reliving Harrison's kiss. It roused in me a restless heat, and even though I told myself it was just an echo of his hormones, it felt very much like longing. I set out to meet Harrison the next morning as planned, managing to make a quick call to Jilly before I left home to explain I wouldn't be at school and why. I had told her only that Harrison and I were going to Shaletown to see if we could learn more about Harlan. If he asked about me, I told her to say she didn't know where I was, which would be true in the most specific sense.
"I believe that is what my gran would call splitting hairs with the devil,"
Jilly had laughed. Then Mum came in, yawning, and I had to end the call. I told Mum that I would be with my friend Harrison after school, and I'd come home late, and she nodded. She would forget to mention it to Da, of course, unless he asked her, then she would tell him. I had left early enough to change into casual clothes at the station, because a uniform was identifiable, and we didn't need any nosy neighbours calling the school to ask what was going on. The train was already at the station when I got out of the washroom, and I was pacing up and down at the platform anxiously when Harrison arrived, late, looking heavy-eyed and flustered.
"Sorry," he said briefly. "Did you get your ticket?"
I shook my head.
"Good. Raoul's gonna drive us."
I stared at him, all the way to Shaletown.
Harrison nodded. "It'll give us more time there, but we have to get the bus over to his place because it'll be quicker in peak hour than for him to drive over to collect us."
It wasn't until we were on the bus that I remembered Raoul had said he would visit Sari and the Orba office on Tuesday. I asked Harrison, who said he'd decided to postpone it to the next day instead. "Is everything okay with you otherwise?" I asked. He glanced at me, and I read his awareness of my extended senses.
"Just home stuff going on," he said. "How did it go with your Da and that Remington gig anyway? I gather he's okay."
"He was so much the same as usual last night that I feel a bit stupid being so worried," I admitted. "Just the same, I told him what Da had said about the gig, and he finally said that maybe Aaron Race just liked exerting his power and influence and seeing what happened, because neither of us could figure out how it could possibly benefit Aaron Race to have Da play a couple of songs with the Rack. Harrison knew of them too, but like me, he didn't like their music.
I guess we're not angry enough to like it," he said.
His words made me think of Rose Cobb, and I asked if there would be time to stop in and say hello while we were in Shaletown. It took us almost an hour to get to Raoul's house, and he opened the door at once, as if he'd been waiting for us. He wheeled straight down the dove-grey hall to a door that led to a garage, which was not visible from outside the house. Here, we got into Raoul's modified car. We had just got to the highway when it started to rain. Raoul switched the windscreen wipers on, and I watched them, half mesmerized, as Raoul made Harrison go over everything that had happened the night before. I dozed a bit and woke, feeling embarrassed, but neither Harrison nor Raoul commented on it. Soon after, I saw the sign welcoming us to Shale Town, familiar because of all the times I had seen it when we had come there with Dar. Raoul pulled the modified car into a car park behind a comfortable-looking bluestone pub, which turned out to have a ramp entry and widened doors for wheelchair access. "How lucky," I murmured, but Harrison said sardonically that he doubted luck had anything to do with it. Raoul gave him an amused look and said he found the pub via the internet when he checked to find one that would be wheelchair-friendly. "You got your computers cleaned up, then?" Harrison asked. Raoul shook his head, manoeuvring into the pub. "I had a third telephone line installed and bought a new computer." He saw my horrified look and laughed. "It was a good lesson not to rely totally on one system," he said. "Daisy will repair the rest when she comes later this week. Now, let's have a quick lunch before you head off." We sat by a window table which looked out into a nice garden. It had stopped raining, and the sun was shining thinly, glistening on leaves and branches. We were studying the menu, and Raoul recommended a vegetable pie, explaining that the pub was listed in the Good Food Guide, and that was the meal of choice. "All right," he said decisively, once we had given our orders to the waitress. "You'd better have these." He took out a map of Shale Town and showed us where Carmine Street was. "As you see, it's not far from the detention center where your friend Rose lives." Harrison had mentioned my desire to see her in the car. Raoul put a mobile phone on the table. "My number is stored in it. Just call or text when you're ready to be collected." Then he put down two clipboards with sheets clipped to them, saying a survey would be a good reason for us to go from house to house, asking questions. "What are you going to do?" I asked him. "I have an appointment at the Shale Town office of Race Incorporated." I gaped at him, and Harrison asked, "He has an office here. Isn't that kind of weird?" Raoul laughed. "I thought that would get a reaction from you both. Yes, he has an office here, and yes, it is odd. Apparently, his wife was living in Shale Town when he met her, and the office building belongs to her, along with some other holdings. She inherited it all when her husband, a self-made Shale Town man called Jamie Macarios, died. He was her second husband, as opposed to the third, which is Aaron Race. Property is tied up, so Race can't touch it, and I suppose he decided he might as well make use of it." "Where did you find out all of this?" I asked worriedly. "Just some clever internet snooping on my new computer. No communication with human beings, and no downloading, so don't worry. I rang the office this morning to say I'd heard Race Incorporated would be able to give me some advice about finding some more meaningful and useful way to donate money. I said that I was driving through today and would like to discuss the matter. His secretary asked who'd given me the name of the office, and I told him I heard it at a cocktail party." "You can't ask him about Da," I said, still not completely reassured. "Of course not. I doubt very much that the man himself will be there. I just like to get a feel for the organization, and I want to know clearly what it does. But you two had better go." I hesitated. Then I reached in my bag and got out my journal. "I've been writing stuff down since the accident, and I thought maybe you'd like to have a look. The last bit is a copy of what I read in that yellow book." Raoul took it, looking pleased, and when we went out, he was already leafing through it. "It's lucky the rain stopped," I said, as we walked briskly along the street. Harrison, Raoul's map in hand, was doing the navigating, and according to him, we were very close to Carmine Street. "Should be the next one," he muttered. It was. Carmine Street turned out to be a wide street with beautiful, well-established trees on both sides, with a glistening carpet of red, brown, and yellow leaves lying beneath them. It was a residential street, and most of the houses were enormous red brick or sandstone mansions with beautiful, well-kept gardens and gleaming, expensive-looking cars sitting in their driveways. "The second car," Harrison said, when I commented on this similarity. He reckoned the first cars would be BMWs or Mercedes. "Just the right setting for a private school," Harrison added. But although we walked the street from end to end, we saw only residential houses. "Nothing that could have been a school," Harrison said. "You sure you got the street right?" "I am, but I bet Raoul would have checked," I said.
Maybe there's more than one Carmine Street in Shale Town.
Nope. Raoul would have checked that too.
We began to make our way back along the street, and having crossed to the other side, I said, maybe it's been turned into a house since it closed.
None of these is big enough to have been a school.
Hey. He had stopped and was gazing back along the street.
That park. We passed at the other end of the street where we started. Was it actually a park? Or could it have been a vacant block?
But they wouldn't pull a whole school down and then not build anything in its place, I protested, following him back. The block that we had taken for a reserve was a huge grassed expanse with nothing to suggest there had ever been any buildings there. But there was no sign saying it was a park either, and around the corner near where the houses began, we found a for sale sign with a phone number of a real estate agent. Harrison said, this must have been it then. There couldn't have been a school here. I protested, unable to imagine it. I mean, it's not big enough.
It would be plenty big enough for the buildings, and lots of schools have their grounds in other places. I bet there's an oval quite near here.
He was examining the map, and sure enough, there was an oval in the next street.
But why would it have been pulled down? I asked.
Could be any number of reasons. It might have been a bit of an eyesore.
In a neighbourhood like this, I cried.
Well, it might just have been a white elephant, hard to sell, so they figured grass would do better.
On the other hand, it's not sold, and I wonder why.
His eyes lit up. I have an idea. He took out the mobile phone that Raoul had given us.
Hello, is this Kern's Real Estate?
Harrison made himself sound older and slightly bossy.
I'd like to speak to someone about the large block on the corner of Carmine Street and Turnpike Road.
His eyes widened, and he gave me a pointed look.
Yes, the big one that used to be a school. I don't suppose you know anything about... Well, can someone else help me? Okay, I'll call back. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
He pressed the end button. The woman who handles it is out to lunch, but that guy definitely said it used to be our school. Let's go canvass the neighbours. We pulled out the clipboards and marched up to number 10 Turnpike Road, the house closest to the vacant block. Harrison rang a doorbell shaped like the head of a lion. No one answered. We tried a few more times and then moved to the next house along. A cleaning woman answered, saying that the owners would be home after 5.
Have you worked here long? Harrison asked. Maybe you can help us. It will not take long.
The cleaning woman sighed and shrugged.
Okay, why not? I've worked here for 2 years.
That block back there on the corner, it was once a school.
The woman frowned.
It was some sort of school, why?
We're doing a project on land use, Harrison lied smoothly.
We're looking at how it's changed and why, whether land has always been vacant or what used to be on it. What happened to the school anyway?
It was neatly done. The woman was diverted from her momentary suspicion.
It was some kind of explosion, I heard. Or maybe it was a fire.
I was glad she was looking towards the block just then, because I couldn't control the jump I gave. But Harrison just asked why it hadn't been rebuilt. The woman shrugged.
Mrs. Callow, she's the owner of this place. She was full of it at the time. Now, let me see. She was sure it had been bombed. Some people have too much money and too little sense to feel all the time they have on their hands.
She glanced down at her own reddened hands complacently.
She was real disappointed when the police found it was an accident. She couldn't go around telling her friends that she lived next door to violent criminals.
She laughed derisively.
What did the police think had happened?
Harrison asked, with the sort of flattering eagerness that storytellers love.
I can't say I recall. It was a boiler that blew up, or maybe a furnace or something. Then there was a fire, and I think people were killed. Or maybe it was one person, and they might only have been injured.
The woman frowned at me.
Is she all right?
I'm fine, I said huskily. I think that pie I ate for lunch might have been a bit strange.
We'd better go. Thanks, Harrison told the woman.
I felt her eyes following us as we passed on down the street and out of her sight into Carmine Street. Harrison made me stop and sit on a fence, saying I was as white as a ghost.
Did you hear what she said? I demanded shakily. There was a fire and someone was killed.
She said maybe a fire and maybe a boiler accident and maybe a bomb,
and maybe someone or a whole lot of someones were killed or injured, Harrison said.
Harrison, you don't understand. When she said there had been a fire, I remembered. The day I told Harlan that Jilly's house had burned down, he asked who did it.
So? Harrison asked, looking baffled.
But don't you get it? I cried. That was the first thing he said. But I didn't say anyone had burned it down. I just said the house had burned down. Why would he jump to the conclusion that someone had burned it? It's proof that he was involved in the fire.
Well, it's not exactly proof, but if he was involved, it suggests this sickness can provoke people to pretty extreme actions, in which case we need to be very careful.
He glanced around and said we'd better get on. We could talk more later about the fire.
Three no answers, and then in the fourth house, an elderly man with a foreign accent came to the door.
Hello, what can I do for you?
His scent was nice and friendly, and there was none of the impatience that I had smelled in the cleaning woman. Harrison explained about the survey. Then he asked about the school.
There was a school that burned down. I had not emigrated then, but my sister wrote of it to me, the old man said. She did not say it was a private school, but that difficult children went there. What is the word you see in the newspaper all the time?
Delinquents.
Yes, it was a school for delinquent boys. But it was a school where the parents are very rich, and so the school was very fine, with many facilities.
I exchanged a glance with Harrison.
Do you know how the school was destroyed? He asked the man. My sister said that it was an accident, some kind of boiler explosion, and then a fire.
Was anyone hurt? I asked.
Yes, you have reminded me. It was a terrible thing. An inspired music teacher died, my sister said. An accomplished violinist. She called him the heart of the school, and it was almost certainly the reason the school was so very successful. A wonderful man who had given his life to helping difficult young men and boys, the old man said.
Your sister seems to have known a lot about the school, Harrison observed.
The man smiled. My sister is the sort of woman who makes it her business to know a lot about everything. Besides, I think there were occasions when the school invited neighbors to performances and concerts to assure them they were not at risk, I suppose.
Was there any suggestion of the explosion being deliberate? Harrison asked.
The old man frowned a little at the question.
My sister would certainly know if there was such a suggestion, and she would have told me. What makes you ask such a question?
I was just curious, Harrison said lamely. We heard there used to be a gang of kids at the school that caused a lot of trouble.
That was a straight-out lie, and I felt myself blush. But Harrison held the old man's gaze as he considered it. At length, he shook his head.
I doubt gangs would have been encouraged or even permitted at such a school. The authorities would be trying to prevent such things, I should imagine.
He shrugged.
I do not know who would have spoken of gangs. Perhaps they were thinking of the gang that set fire to the bakery a few weeks ago.
Harrison shot me a look and then said,
A gang set fire to the bakery.
The old man shifted from one slipper-clad foot to the other, and I smelled the faint mustiness of his fatigue.
It was madness. There was no money or expensive jewelry to be stolen, and a woman who ran the place is not the sort of person to have alienated anyone. Indeed, she's a wonderful woman, and gave work to young people whom no one else would employ.
He sighed. Harrison held out his hand.
Well, we'd better get on. Thank you for your help, sir.
The door closed as we walked down the street, and Harrison said,
What do you make of all that?
I don't see how a gang who vandalizes a bakery would have anything to do with Harlan and his sickness.
Unless the vandalism is some sort of initiation rite, proof of commitment, he added with emphasis.
I didn't say anything. I was thinking of a woman who had employed difficult young people whose bakery had been burned, and a musician whose work had inspired delinquent boys killed in a fire, almost as if they were being harmed for their goodness.
34. We tried several other houses,
but the occupants either did not want to speak with us or were not at home or had moved to the street since the school had closed down. The sky had gradually darkened. Harrison eyed the clouds looming up overhead and said we might as well give up and go and see Rose Cobb, because any minute the heavens were going to open. It took 20 minutes to reach the detention center, and the wind was buffeting at us by the time it came in sight. I noticed a small group of protesters set up on the lawn beside the entrance, hurriedly pulling plastic bags over their placards and loading them into a dark green van. As we drew level, they got into the van and drove away. "Which house?" Harrison asked, as thunder rumbled. "This way," I called. Lightning flashed overhead, and as if it were a signal, it began to rain hard. We broke into a run. In moments we were standing on Rose's front porch, rain lashing at our backs. "I hope she's home, and doesn't mind letting in a couple of drowned rats," Harrison said ruefully. I knocked at the blistered green door with a sudden stab of doubt. I had only met Rose Cobb once, however well we had got along. What if I had misunderstood her invitation? What if she had forgotten me? Before I could voice my apprehensions, the door opened, and Rose stared out at me blankly. But at once, to my great relief, her face collapsed into the warm, kind smile I remembered. "Alison, my dear girl, how lovely to see you. Come in, you and your friend. This house faces right into the teeth of the wind, so the veranda is all but useless as any kind of shelter." She stood back, and the wind seemed to push us through the door and into her little hallway. Harrison caught hold of the door and wrestled it closed, and we all laughed. Rose made us take off our coats, and after I introduced Harrison, told us to go in and sit by the fire while she made some tea. Harrison grinned at me, and I grinned back. With his damp and wildly tousled hair and half-fogged glasses, he looked cheerful but slightly demented. It wasn't until we got into the lounge room that I realized Rose had another visitor. It was the big, simple-minded young man who'd been with her the last time I saw her, Davy. He rose and stared at us both. I was startled to see his hands were stained black to the wrists. Davy, I said awkwardly, "this is my friend Harrison, and I'm..." "You're Alison Whitestar," Davy said, not even glancing at Harrison. "I know who you are, but you shouldn't say your name, because the air remembers it, and some people can read the air. Sniff the names out of it like dogs sniff up each other's P-words," Davy said earnestly. Rose Cobb bustled into the startled silence with a tray, and Harrison sprang up to help her lay the table. She said loudly to Davy, "This is Harrison, Davy. Harrison." Davy shifted his regard to Harrison. "What awful weather it is, but that's winter for you," Rose Cobb said, beginning to pour tea. It was only after we had tea in a scone with jam that she asked what we were doing in Shale Town. "We had some stuff to do," I said vaguely. "I actually thought you might be across the road. Silly when it's raining." "We try not to let the rain stop us," Rose said. "But today there were some of the other protesters there, and, well, sometimes things get rough when they're there, so I don't go over on those days." "Other protesters?" I asked curiously. "Oh, there are all kinds of protesters. Not that I would have known it once upon a time. There are the ones like Gwenny and her friends, who are peaceful protesters. And then there are those who are determined to make a point, no matter what it takes. Angry, violent protesters," she added, looking to see if I remembered our last conversation. I nodded. "The ones over there today seemed to be what I call political protesters. I like that sort least, because what they want never seems to have much to do with helping people." "They are bad," Davy said. Rose took his hand and patted it, looking at Harrison and me. "I'm afraid they were rather rude to me when I went to offer them some tea and scones. It upset Davy." She patted his hand. "Simon says they are bad," he told her, patting her hand back in exactly the same consoling way, and leaving no mark despite the stains on his hands. "Simon says Davy needs to go home soon." "But it's still raining, dear," Rose objected. "Davy will not get wet," Davy said serenely. Then he turned to look at Harrison. He was just then glancing down at his watch. "You know what? We have a friend with a car, and we were supposed to call him to pick us up.
We can give Davy a lift home.
What a good idea. What do you think, Davy?
Rose asked.
Davy must go in the car and show the driver where to go,
Davy said complacently, as if repeating instructions. Harrison called Raoul while Rose told